The magnetosphere is Earth's invisible magnetic shield in space surrounding the planet that shields the surface from harmful solar radiation. It acts as a protective barrier, deflecting most of the charged particles from the sun, which prevents the Earth's atmosphere from being stripped away and makes surface life possible. Without this protection, the solar wind would erode the atmosphere, which is vital for protecting biological organisms from harmful ultraviolet radiation. That said, the Earth's magnetosphere is not perfectly stable and is constantly fluctuating in strength and shape due to complex processes. There are also magnetic pole shifts or reversals, long periods of time when the magnetosphere dramatically weakens or vanishes, and the Earth's surface is vulnerable and exposed to high levels of cosmic or solar radiation. One such incident is known as the Lastchamp event, also termed the Adams event, which involved the temporary reversal of Earth's magnetic poles. Something dramatic happened 42,000 years ago when Earth lost at least 95% of the magnetosphere. During this event, the planet's magnetic field weakened dramatically to as low as 5 to 10% of its current strength for roughly 1,000 to 2,000 years, exposing the surface to solar energetic particle bombardment. Taking approximately 2 millennia to fully return, Cro-Magnon, in places like Western Europe, sought refuge inside of caves, safe from the sun's merciless radiation, which is why they are traditionally referred to as cavemen. These deep cavern systems lead well below the surface into self-sustaining subterranean habitats with abundant water supply, oxygen-producing algae, bioluminescent plants, glowing fungus, and radiant lichen lining the walls, providing a perpetual diffused light. Without the need for excessive melanin, Cro-Magnon retained its fair complexion, as it has always had since first appearing in the human fossil record. Cro-Magnon also had blue eyes, which were preserved by the shelter provided by the caves, as blue eyes can see better in low light conditions, so it makes sense that their fair and recessive phenotype was preserved in the inner Earth environment until they finally emerged and dominated the other hominins on the surface. This Lastchamp event had likely contributed to the extinction of Neanderthals. Some of their genetics live on in modern non-African populations, with present-day Europeans being comprised of 1 to 2% Neanderthal admixture, and East Asians having about 20% more, at around 2.5%. It was the shelter of the inner Earth caves that modern humans emerged from to repopulate the Earth, as described in many myths and legends, such as those passed down from the Hopi Indians that claim they emerged from inside of the Grand Canyon, or Tibetans and Buddhists that speak of inner Earth kingdoms of Agartha or Shambhala. They did not mutate white skin, they emerged white. Other surface hominins did not, explaining the high melanin adaptation in species such as Homo erectus. The dark skin was an adaptation to the surface radiation, being exposed to periodic epochs in Earth's history, when the planet is exposed to high doses of cosmic radiation, and melanin in the eyes and skin become a necessity for survival. It is likely that hominins such as Homo habilis and Homo erectus benefited from high melanin as far back as 780,000 years ago, when the Earth experienced a complete reversal of its magnetic field. It is these super archaic hominin species that are likely referred to as the ghost species that comprise up to 19% of the sub-Saharan African genome, which is not found in the DNA of present-day Asians or Caucasians. The interbreeding event that introduced super archaic ghost species admixture into Africans happened about 50,000 years ago. Cro-Magnon populated Europe about 40,000 years ago, and were already fully genetically modern European, without any ghost species admixture whatsoever. Therefore, it is clear that sub-Saharan Africans did not mutate into Asians or Caucasians, and the out-of-Africa replacement model, which has made such a claim for the past several decades, has now been rendered obsolete in the light of genetic sequencing. Black Africans did not leave Africa and evolve into white Europeans, as mainstream anthropologists have contended since the 1980s, by claiming there was no cross-species interbreeding. Instead, the ancestors of non-Africans likely emerged from caves as the surface became less environmentally hostile, diffusing across the planet, likely perceived as gods, as described by the world's mythologies and religions, and interbred with the surface hominins, giving rise to the various modern hybridized races.
We have sequenced the genome of a 37,000-year-old individual from Europe, meaning it's one of the oldest modern humans found in Europe. And this genome basically reveals three different things. First of all, and this is very surprising, we can see that all the major genetic components present in living day Europeans were already present in Europeans 37,000 years ago. And that changes the whole concept of how Europe was populated, where we previously thought, well, it was massive movements of people from outside into Europe providing genes. Now it is the data suggests no, there was like this meta population of people stretching all the way from Europe to Central Asia, exchanging genes in a very complex network with each other.
How did the different types or races of man, if you will, appear on the planet?
By hybrid mixes. And that's how all the races came about, through mixings and crossbreeding.
Yeah, because I never bought into the story that someone could walk out of Africa and then over time, the skin tone changes, the facial features, and the structure of the hair changes. I never really bought into that.
Yeah, and that's what we're taught, and that's what textbooks say, but it's false, and we need to understand what the true history is. Out of Africa, the African Garden of Eden has become a strict part of the Darwinian paradigm. This is where the professors and experts tell us that all mankind came from Africa. I don't believe this is true. This is only about 25 years ago that the African Garden of Eden, the African Eve, became popular and became a fixed idea in Darwinian evolutionism. But it's not true. And as you say, it would be impossible for the African to migrate out and go to Sweden and turn white, to go to China and turn yellow. Those are fairy tales that they're still teaching in school.
Another phenomena that emerged from the last CHAMP event was the use of red ochre in the archaeological record exactly around this time. Cro-Magnon did not just use it for cave art. They smeared it liberally on their bodies, buried their dead covered in it, and carried lumps of it in pouches. This is one of the earliest unambiguous signs of symbolic behavior, but it may have also had a practical adaptive component as well. Red ochre, or iron oxide, has been shown in modern studies to reflect and absorb UV radiation extremely efficiently, comparable to or better than modern mineral sunscreens. A layer of red ochre mixed with animal fat and applied to the skin as a paint would provide protection from the kind of radiation that becomes more dangerous during the last CHAMP type geomagnetic minimum. The sudden, widespread adoption of red ochre body painting coincides almost perfectly with the last CHAMP event. Before 43,000 years ago, red ochre use is rare and sporadic. After 41,000 years ago, it becomes common in Western Europe, where Cro-Magnon was discovered, and persists for tens of thousands of years. This timing is unlikely to be coincidence. In fact, it was also used by the direct descendants of Cro-Magnon, such as the Guanche natives of the Canary Islands. They were tall, blonde and red-headed, built small stone pyramids, and used red ochre for body painting. Archaeological finds confirm their use of red ochre through artifacts like mortars used for grinding the pigment and painting themselves. Incidentally, Edgar Cayce, the American clairvoyant known as the Sleeping Prophet, connected the Canary Islands to the fabled Atlantis, mentioning places like Tenerife and the surrounding islands, such as the Azores, as mountain peaks or remnants of the eastern portion of Atlantis that survived the final cataclysms when sea levels rose 400 feet at the end of the Pleistocene. He also placed Atlantean survivors or their descendants in the Canary Island region, calling Atlanteans or Cro-Magnon the, quote, red people, belonging to the fourth root race or the red race. Cayce also sometimes linked the Basque region of Spain, the Pyrenees, where Cro-Magnon was discovered, and parts of Morocco to surviving Atlantean colonies. The Basque are also descendants of Cro-Magnon, and ancient populations in the Pyrenees also used red ochre paint extensively. It was used not only for cave walls, but also for body painting, burials, and possibly symbolic or ritual purposes. The Maritime Archaic, or Red Paint People, were genetically related to the Basque, but were the seafaring indigenous people who lived along the coast of the Atlantic Canada, Newfoundland, and northern New England from about 7,000 BC. They predated populations that the Europeans encountered and called the Red Skin Indians, who also applied red ochre paint to their white skin, not because they were racially red-skinned. The ancient Minoans, who are also white, appear with red ochre body paint 4,000 years ago, as did the white Phoenicians, which comes from the Greek word phoenix, which means red, and they share genetic affinities with the Europeans, according to sequenced DNA from a Phoenician from Carthage. The Etruscans also applied red ochre paint to themselves. They predated the Roman Empire, and were the last kings of Rome, marking the end of the Roman kingdom and the beginning of the Roman Republic. Red ochre body paint was also common among the ancient Berbers, or Amazigh, predecessors to the Moors, the white native indigenous people of North Africa, who shared genetic affinities with the Basque and Guanche people and carried on the tradition to many ancient civilizations of their Cro-Magnon descendants, such as the ancient Egyptians, who applied red ochre to their bodies, mummies, and depicted themselves as red in art. Of course, many Afrocentrists are oblivious to the red ochre tradition and believe this reflects skin tone, despite genetic analysis of Egyptian pharaohs sharing racial ties with Europeans and ancient white inhabitants of the Levant prior to the Arab invasions and slave trade. This woke interpretation of history is mirrored by Swedish television depicting ancient Swedes as black, and the Netflix series Vikings Valhalla, which includes black actors in prominent roles. Perhaps no bigger fraud has been pushed by the media in recent times than the false announcement that the Cheddar Man, who lived about 10,000 years ago in Europe, had dark or black skin and blue eyes. Not only are blue eyes most common with blonde hair and fair skin, as the genes for these traits are often inherited together, but studies show a strong genetic correlation between blue eyes and fair features, with these traits being influenced by a number of genes that are located close together on the same chromosomes, meaning they're more likely to be passed down as a pair along with fair skin. In fact, a direct descendant of Cheddar Man in the UK, has blue eyes and fair skin. That said, the original prediction that the Cheddar Man was black was based on a small number of incomplete genetic codes. And more importantly, subsequent ancient Western hunter-gatherers and Scandinavian hunter-gatherers from the same period frequently carry lightning alleles at other pigmentation genes, meaning the simple two-gene model used in the 2018 announcement was an oversimplification and unreliable. In fact, Susan Walsh, the geneticist involved with the statement that Cheddar Man likely had dark skin, did clarify shortly after her 2018 announcement that the conclusion was not definitive, emphasizing the limitations of ancient DNA analysis due to degradation and incomplete genetic models for skin pigmentation at the time, which did not fully capture ancient variations. That said, Cheddar Man was actually heterozygous at the main light skin allele, meaning he had two different alleles for the single most particular European light skin variant. In my estimation, there's no way Cheddar Man was black or dark-skinned and at most had the complexion of a modern Sardinian, not a sub-Saharan African as represented in the reconstructed bust presented to the media by Marxist academics with a political agenda of pushing mass migration and demographic replacement.
The Cheddar Man reconstruction was advised by a scientist called Tom Booth, who works with the Natural History Museum. 2017, he worked on a paper with my former university, UCL, where he complains about racists and right-wing people and Brexit and how geneticists have a duty to try and prevent people from identifying with ancestral populations because that feeds into nationalist narratives. Recently, after having all this time of him encouraging black people in UK to believe Cheddar Man was like them somehow and like a part of, like, racially like them or genetically related to them, even though he knows perfectly well that Cheddar Man has no relation to them. He'd made a tweet saying something along the lines, I have to paraphrase, like, now that black people have identified with Cheddar Man is politically black because he's part of their cultural frameworks. Like, you just lied to make them think that. And then you say, because they believe the lie, therefore now it has to be true because it's part of their cultural experience of being British and black. So it's completely unscientific. It's so dishonest.
Although the world is undergoing a genetic revolution where breakthroughs in DNA sequencing are providing anthropologists with answers to some of life's greatest mysteries, there are still those who deny what is scientifically correct in favor of what is politically correct, attacking anyone that dares speak the truth. When the debate is lost, slander becomes the tool of the loser.
There are people that are Atlantis hunters today. There's the guy, Robert Saphir. I hate to say his name even, but I will because he needs to be put on blast a bit. This guy he's an Atlantis bro. He thinks that the DNA story that we've been told out of Africa is wrong. Okay, fine, whatever. Where the rubber hits the road is when he starts seeing, he'll show like pictures of like old school anthropological models of proto-humans that are real dark skin and big hair coming out and looking half monkey, half man. And then he'll say, there's no way that this could come from the same stock, and then show like a little six-year-old Danish girl with perfect fucking big blue eyes. Mm. And this is this kind of constant digs at Africans, not out of Africa, but at Africa. They were all these different species bred with different hominids, and these guys bred with the stupid ones, and these other guys bred with smart ones, and these guys bred with strong ones. And it's like, it's racist, for lack of a better term. It might not even be what you would consider white supremacist, but it's definitely, when you're done with, if you were to take everything he said and accept it, you would walk away thinking that different groups of humans are clearly better than each other genetically, fucking hands down, and you can judge it based on skin. So that is racist, right?
But what does that have to do with Atlantis?
Well, he believes that Atlantis was like the people that spread the ideas around and stuff. Kind of the same stuff I was saying earlier about that Ignatius Donnelly guy.
Oh, okay.
So he is what you would think. He's got 300,000 subscribers or so on YouTube. He's not a nobody. So you would think he's the guy that these guys would be poking at for being a fucking racist. But They don't. And there's a real big reason why they almost never do. There's like two people with any following at all that have letters next to their name that have taken shots at this guy on YouTube. And the reason is he is what they actually claim Graham is. So it's like if you have somebody that's complaining about a trans activist, the one that's screaming, "Call me ma'am," that's what they're trying to say Graham is. But actually, that's what Robert is. And then Graham's just would be standing there being like, "Hey, how's it going?"
So the problem is if you pay attention to that guy and you see the real racist, then it doesn't work when you call Graham a racist.
That you can't call him a racist anymore, yeah.
Yeah.
And so they...
Also, they probably don't want to give him any attention.
Well, they give him attention. They talk about him. They do. They just... like I said, I didn't even want to mention his name. And I know I'm going to get people yelling at me about saying that. But it's... the stuff that he puts out is very clearly... if you were to... Again, if you take it all on board, it would be very... You would be a racist.
But what would you call Robert? What would you call Robert? Racist. Fucking racist, right? Clearly, white supremacist, racist.
My name is Robert Sepper. I'm an anthropologist. My published work is available on Amazon and through all other major book outlets. If you'd like to support my work, you can do that through patreon.com. There should be a link in the description. Have a wonderful weekend, and I hope to see you again soon.